From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. We've got a great show for you in store tonight. Here's what's happening. The Chinese military apparently has built targets in the shape of an American aircraft carrier and other U.S. warships out there in the desert in China as part of a new target range complex. What are they up to? The full-scale outline of a U.S. carrier and at least two destroyers are part of a target range that has been built in central China. The site is near a former target range that China used to test early versions of its so-called carrier killer anti-ship ballistic missile. This new range shows that China continues to focus on anti-carrier capabilities. Biotech giant Regeneron has claimed that its antibody cocktail reduces the risk of COVID-19 infection by nearly 82% for up to 8 months. The company announced the results of its clinical trials in partnership with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Walmart said it has started using fully driverless trucks in its online grocery store business, aiming to increase capacity and reduce inefficiencies, as they say. Our expert on the internet, Lauren Weinstein, with us. Lauren, I am so opposed to driverless trucks, but what are they up to?
Well, I don't think you really have to worry about this yet. This isn't quite what springs to mind when you hear about driverless trucks. This is apparently a fixed, constrained, low-traffic, low-interference route specifically between a fulfillment center and a nearby store. Now, the big deal that has been in the media today about this has been that there's no safety driver in the driver's seat, but there apparently is someone in the passenger seat with some access to controls in emergencies or odd situations, plus there's apparently an observation chase vehicle as well. So there's a lot of safety elements to this that don't spring to mind immediately. A likely intractable problem with truly autonomous truck deliveries, and that means no human riding along or following behind, is you don't want people able to stop the truck by blocking it in the front of the back. The truck doesn't have a driver to move anything like that out of the way. And then you're going to see truck robberies, right? There's no driver to worry about.
That's right.
You're going to see these kinds of hijackings. If they wear full masks, the cameras, of course, there's a lot of cameras on these vehicles, aren't going to do much good, and remote support personnel hooked into the vehicle aren't going to do much about it either. You can bet that as autonomous vehicles become more and more common, just blocking them off for kicks is going to become a thing because there's nobody to get out to move something aside if somebody rushes out and blocks it. Now, what most people imagine about this area when you talk about autonomous trucks is, of course, deliveries to the home, right? But when you think about it, that's a really tough nut to crack. And one obvious question is, where do you leave the packages?
That's right. Right? You can't fly them down to your porch, which is what Amazon wants to try.
Where do you put them? At the curb? That'll be great.
They're gone.
Rains or whatever, right? And if you're not dealing with single-family houses, it's even worse. Think about apartment buildings. So what are we going to do? We can have little robots that come out from the truck and go slowly rolling along and try to get up the porch stairs and while the truck is sitting there waiting to move on. There's all kinds of stuff you could do in theory with this technology. It's amazing technology, but it quickly turns into a very expensive and complicated proposition when you're talking about vast numbers of deliveries a day under all sorts of different conditions compared with a human delivery person who can very quickly deal with all these kinds of issues. So, yeah, it seems likely that we're not going to see widespread use of automated deliveries to ordinary customers anytime very soon. But indeed, on constrained routes, simple routes between businesses that have been set up to deal with them, like this Walmart situation, there are going to be ways to utilize this tech now and in the near future in these kinds of controlled environments. But it's a long, long tail of problems to get past that. I'm not saying it'll never happen, but I think there's a lot of hype surrounding this area, and I don't think we're going to be seeing the mass delivery of packages to consumers by automated, fully autonomous vehicles anytime soon at all.
Thanks, Lauren. I appreciate it. We've got a lot of truck drivers who are listeners to this program, and once again, we are opposed to driverless trucks. With exactly 1 year until the midterm elections, President Biden, Vice President Harris, and Democrats in Congress face bleak ratings that indicate they could be in for a rout in 2022, according to a new USA Today poll. The survey, which was taken after the Tuesday elections but before the House Democrats passed the popular infrastructure bill on Friday, shows that President Biden with nearly rock-bottom approval ratings, Harris with numbers that are even worse, and Democrats trailing by a wide margin on the generic congressional ballot. What else is going on in the skies these days? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cate. Stephen, what do you got for us?
Hey, George, we begin with space, always jam-packed information. How about this? The Chinese launch a sort of spacecraft known as a satellite crusher. What is this? On October the 24th, China, George, launched a new type of satellite known officially as Shoujian 21, in Chinese meaning time. What is it? It's a new spacecraft which has a primary role as a space junk removal system. With its powerful arm, it can crush satellites in low Earth orbit. But many in the U.S. military are concerned about China going counter space. George, just hours ago, the Crew Dragon 2, with its four astronauts, successfully returned to Earth after a nearly 200-day stay on the International Space Station. That happened Monday evening at 10:33 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. An amazing nighttime recovery off the Florida coast by the Crew Dragon recovery ship known as Go Navigator. George, many people in that part of the southern part of the United States witnessed what looked like an incredible fireball as it returned to Earth. But even more interesting, we have a Crew Dragon 3 crew that's scheduled to go to the ISS or launch at least by November 10th after a delay, and it too has four new astronauts on board. George, we shift gears and talk about astronomy. How about another large asteroid to pass the Earth on December the 11th? Here we go again. Of the now 2,231 potentially hazardous asteroids, we will have an Apollo asteroid with its designation 1982 DB, or 4660 Nereus. This object was discovered back in 1982, and it will pass us on December the 11th, as I mentioned. The asteroid's at least 1,108 feet in size, equivalent to the near length of, let's say, a nuclear-powered Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, and traveling past us at a speed of some 15,000 miles, coming at a safe distance of 2.4 million miles. It's named after the Greek god, Nereus, that is, noted for his wisdom and his ability to change his shape. But the asteroid is actually, strange enough, egg-shaped unto itself. But I have even more interesting information, George. But asteroid 2021 UA1 passed us by 1,800 miles over Antarctica on October the 24th. Now, that was discovered 4 hours after its closest approach. It's the size of a refrigerator, and just to put this in perspective, it's like the distance between New York and Colorado, and that little refrigerator passed us by 1,800 miles in its shape size. The live sky, George, as we wrap it up, as we move into the next week in November, look to the southwest. As people are telling me, I'm getting many emails on this, as the beautiful Venus and Moon conjunction continues in the southwest. But if you miss this one, a better one will happen as a conjunction of both Venus and the Moon on the night of December the 6th, when both of those objects will be a fraction of a degree apart, most stunning to the eye. The Moon passes Jupiter on the 11th, then the next full moon, the full Beaver Moon on the 19th, the longest lunar eclipse of the entire century. And George will give out the best times to look at that next week. Emails, we love them, drskyshow@gmail.com, theskylive.com for more great information. What? Always simply remember to keep your eyes to the skies. I'm your navigator on the highway to the heavens.
Sky, hold on for just a second. I want to talk with you about that asteroid when we come back in just a moment, because there are some people who are concerned about it, and I want to get your take on it. We will be back in a moment with talking with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky, about an asteroid that's headed this way in December. It's supposed to miss us by a long, long way, but who knows? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. We're going to chat with him for a little bit about this December asteroid. There seems to be some concern about it, but it's going to miss us by a while, Stephen, won't it?
Absolutely, George. They're saying 2.4 million miles, which in astronomy, even though that seems like a big number to many, it's a safe distance, as opposed to the asteroid that I just described before. And the problem here is, and it's, I guess, a universal problem until we can get better detection systems. How about that asteroid, George, that passed us, like I said, on October the 24th within 1,800 miles, even if it's as small as a refrigerator. The point is, it was discovered 4 hours after.
That's right, when it already has gone past us. Jeez.
Absolutely. So what about something larger? And for people out there curious about this, George, about, well, maybe people may be scratching their heads saying, well, why can't they find these things? These particular asteroids are coming from, let's say, behind the sun. So in other words, as we're looking in the daylight sky, let's say, the object is coming and sneaking up behind the sun. So it's almost, and I can't say impossible, but it's extremely difficult for detection systems, at least now, unless we have something positioned out in space. And maybe there's some hope that the James Webb telescope, once it's deployed, might be able to give us, who knows, maybe even a better warning, but its purpose is a little different.
Well, I got to tell you, Stephen, this is incredible. Now, in your opinion, what are asteroids anyways? How are they formed? What are they? Are they planets that have blown up or rocks that have just never, you know, accumulated with other rocks? What are they?
Well, it's more likely, George, that they never coalesced into a planet, because when this whole proto-solar system formed about 4.5 billion years ago, many of the speculation is out there, and I always had a hard time in school understanding this concept. When you have objects that form into planets, they say over billions of years, gravitational pressure and friction causes the thing to solidify. Well, what these objects are in space are just debris that maybe never formulated, or one theory could be that it was smacked by something even larger. And that asteroid belt, as most people know from basic 101 astronomy, is between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter for the most part. So these asteroids that we're talking about now, particularly this one, 1982 DB, or otherwise known, and its other stage name is 4660 Nereus, it's one of the asteroid groups called one of the Apollo asteroids. So to not make this too complicated, their semi-major axis of their orbit, their semi-major orbit, is actually greater than that of the Earth. So what they do is they're swinging out beyond the Earth and coming in near the Earth's orbit, one of many types of asteroids. But simply, George, asteroids are probably remnants of the solar system creation that never formulated into planets. And the largest one we know of is another of the dwarf objects called Ceres, spelled C-E-R-E-S, probably about the size of the state of Texas. And it's one of the most strange, one of the strangest objects, in my opinion, because it's spherical, as opposed to many of these objects that look like they're jagged and rough-edged like a potato.
Now, the object that wiped out the dinosaurs, that was about, 6 kilometers, which was...
About 6, but some say 5 to 7 kilometers. And, of course, this again happened twice in geologic history. A lot of people think it just happened once 65 million years ago. It's thought, very scientifically, that this happened once before, even another time period before that. But the one that caused this Chicxulub event, that they call it, in the area of the Gulf of Mexico, is an object that was probably about that size. And its impact was obviously a global killer for the most part. I mean, I imagine how the dinosaurs must have felt then. But the Earth was hit. And the strange description that people have described about this event was, and nobody was there to do it, was that what happened was when it actually shattered and ripped apart the sky, but it actually sucked up the atmosphere and everything with it and formulated this big dark cloud around the Earth for who knows how long it lasted, but simply we know vegetation and animal life ceased to exist from just an object that was maybe 5 to 7 kilometers in size.
There was an object a few years ago over Russia that kind of blew up before. It didn't hit the ground, but it blew up in the atmosphere. But a lot of people were injured because of that concussion.
Absolutely, and that's the Chicxulub event that we're talking about. No, that was the Chelyabinsk event. Excuse me, I got
that's right.
Chicxulubs. It was the Chelyabinsk event. And this happened, as we know, back in 2013. And what's amazing about it, George, is that the object was 66 feet in diameter. And the story about how people went to the hospital were injured, it was not from the debris. It was from the actual sonic boom and explosion that this object caused. So even an object 66 feet in diameter, nickel iron or stony material, caused that much damage. And we know here in Arizona, the great tourist attraction is still, and I love it every time I go there, and I'm sure people have seen it or will see it, is the great Arizona meteor crater that was allegedly formed 50,000 years ago by an object, now get a load of this, folks, and George, some 200 feet in diameter, causing at least a mile-ish or so crater here on the Earth, and it's still one of the freshest craters that we can actually study, and there's a lot of story about that. It's just an amazing sight from something 200 feet. Allegedly across.
Steve, does gravity pull in asteroids too?
Absolutely. And one of the things we should be grateful for when you go outside at night, and as I mentioned always in our Live Sky edition here to give, and by the way, people tell me, George, that they love that part of this report because it's stuff you can actually see.
Yes.
Because obviously there's so much science out there. I wish we had more time. But I'm grateful for the time we have now. But yes, gravity is a main thing as far as what happens with these asteroids, the gravitational force of not only the sun, but mentioning Jupiter. Jupiter, if it were not there, many astronomers simply believe, and scientists know, that Jupiter is like this great magnet for objects. So gravity, of course, does affect it. And within the last year or two, George, and visually, I know some people around the world that have video cameras when they're observing Jupiter in the telescope. And what they see, or what they saw, is very infrequent, is large flashes that happen on the surface of the cloud tops. So what's happening is Jupiter's like a giant vacuum cleaner, and we should be grateful for it. But let's keep it far enough away. It's over 400 million miles away now. But obviously, if we were to get close to it, as we would say the moon, its intense gravity and its intense radiation would obviously make us not have a good day.
It is amazing. It really is. The Tunguska blast of 1908. Why is it everything happens over Russia?
Well, I guess because here's a simple answer. It's so large. And if it has what? I'm not sure of this, but what, 10 or 12 time zones? That's pretty big. And obviously, we just got off daylight saving time for a good part of the United States, except for Arizona, of course. But here, George, this is something interesting. That event, June 30th, 1908, still goes down in the record book as one of the most amazing events of all time. It theoretically could be a chunk of a comet. Some thought Comet Encke, some thought even in the most bizarre explanation, but I can't rule it out, that it was an interplanetary spacecraft that actually exploded over the Earth. Who knows? But from the asteroid section in astronomy, that event leveled trees about the size of the state of Connecticut. And it wasn't until the 1920s that somebody actually went there, a scientific expedition, and they looked and they saw this amazing destruction from an object that didn't hit the Earth, George. What it did, it was an airburst like that of a nuclear weapon. And who knows on the megaton scale how big it was, but probably bigger or larger than Russia's largest event in its atmospheric test called Tsar Bomba, which supposedly was a 100 megaton explosion. These things, obviously, we hope don't happen in our near future, but I know there's a movie coming out. I think it's with, I'm trying to think who it is, Leonardo DiCaprio. It's about, I don't know the title, forgive me, folks, George, but it's something about look at the sky, and it's about a obvious comet or asteroid that comes to strike the Earth. Here we go again, right?
What did you think of the movie with Bruce Willis where he was on an asteroid and stayed to blow it up to save the planet?
Well, I thought he did a great job, but it's all in the sci-fi world. But
is that conceivable?
Well, let me say this. I don't believe truly that we could stand on the surface of an asteroid comet for a long time. But I think they got it right, particularly with the comet, because here we go. This thing was venting gases. And I remember going back in my time tunnel that if you look at the surface of one of these objects, you see him standing on a thing that looks like it has geysers. I don't think we could conceivably stand there. So it's probably going to have to be some sort of robotic craft. And they're describing this. I mean, you've heard this, I'm sure, a million times, George, that they even have the concept now of using nuclear warheads to do deflection. And years ago, that was considered to be one of the most ludicrous concepts. And again, the theory about not doing it or the reason not to do it is you blow something up like that and you create a whole lot of Chelyabinsk and a lot of other things, maybe like the Tunguska event coming from a singular object. By destroying it, you're probably asking for a lot more trouble. But simply to answer your question, I thought the movie was great, but that's something that maybe in the next 20 or 30 years we might be able to do, but I don't think right yet.
Well, can you imagine what would happen? Oh, my gosh. If you're right, if they blew up an asteroid and we had thousands of 66 feet, 2-mile pieces coming our way.
Well, George, there's another theoretical thing, and I don't want to scare people out there. It's never my mission and never yours. We just want to inform them. But imagine this. Let's say an object the size of, let's say, much smaller than Chicxulub, the great 65 million year ago event. Let's say we had an object maybe larger than the Chelyabinsk event, maybe bigger than Tunguska, and it actually struck the moon. Now, for astronomers and sky watchers, that'd be one hell of a view because you'd see this material just hit the surface of the moon. But look at all that residual material that would be heading our way, too. So we're lucky that the moon hasn't been hit, or an object like the Earth as frequently, because obviously the moon has minimalist atmosphere, if you want to call it at all. It has a tiny, tiny atmosphere, hardly negligible and measurable. But the Earth, obviously, with its atmosphere, has protected us from some of the smaller events. But that would be pretty catastrophic, too. An object striking the lunar surface would put on a great sky show. But then hold on, folks, hold on to your hat, because the residual debris would be coming probably within a day, maybe even shorter than that, headed our direction.
Spell out your website, Stephen, for folks.
What we like to have people do, George, always go to theskylive.com. We have a corroboration with one of the most amazing websites of all. Check that out, and I think people will get a lot to learn there. It's amazing, George. You can find out planetary positions, learn about comets and all the things that are happening out there. So theskylive.com is what we talk about here on Coast to Coast with you, and I always appreciate the time to spend with you.
Super. Thank you, Dr. Sky. What do the deaths of Marilyn Monroe, Dorothy Kilgallen, and John F. Kennedy have to do with each other? Up next, Mark Shaw on Coast to Coast AM. In a moment, Mark Shaw joins us to talk about the strange parallels of the deaths of Marilyn Monroe, journalist Dorothy Kilgallen, and JFK. An amazing story, and nobody researches this better than Mark Shaw. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. If you want to live in a condominium where Marilyn Monroe once lived, it's going to cost you a pretty penny. The late Hollywood actress briefly stayed in the penthouse of the Granville Towers after her divorce from New York Yankees outfielder Joe DiMaggio back in 1954. And now the condo is up for sale at a $2.49 million asking price. Wow. Well, let me tell you about our special guest who's done work into Marilyn Monroe's death, Dorothy Kilgallen, and John F. Kennedy, the author of 20-plus books, Mark Shaw, the former legal analyst for USA Today, CNN, and USA Today, California attorney and investigative reporter who has dedicated the past several years to probing the truth about the JFK, Lee Harvey Oswald assassinations through his works, and also, of course, Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen, the late journalist who was also on the television program What's My Line. Mark, welcome back, my friend.
Oh, thank you, George. Good to talk to you again.
Hard to believe we're coming up on 58 years since JFK was assassinated.
Well, that's right, and it's rather amazing. But it's been quite an amazing time for me the last 3 or 4 months because a lot of the research that I've done confirms a lot of the theories and conclusions I had in Collateral Damage, you know, the latest book of mine. But it all kind of just, you know, comes together with everything happening. The president's refusal to release the JFK documents as required by law, and new information that I found about Carlos Marcello and Dorothy and Marilyn and all of this. So it's been really an exciting time for me that way. And, you know, I'll be interested to know what your reactions are to some of the things that I've been able to discover. But, you know, this Collateral Damage, you know, it's interesting. Somebody said to me the other day, Mark, you know, people have written books about JFK's assassination. They've written books about Marilyn. They've written books about Dorothy. But nobody's ever written about all three of them at the same time. And I'm not exactly sure how I was able to do that with Collateral Damage. But it changes everything when you do that, especially when you look at those three deaths in the context of the JFK assassination and also Bobby Kennedy's abuse of power in 1961 and 1962.
Well, I got to tell you, Mark, all of you researchers who have written and researched these incredible situations ought to be commended, but you have gone beyond the norm with all of your work, and I just really enjoy when you're on the program because this is a subject matter that is dear to me, too. I mean, it's a fascination. Our country has never been the same since 1963, as far as I'm concerned.
No, I don't think it has. You know, that was a turning point. Many people have said to me, I'd be interested to know what you think, George, but that our country lost its innocence then.
Yep,
for some reason.
We sure
I'm
did.
Not sure exactly why that was. Do you agree with that?
I do. And also, I wanted to ask you if you ever had a chance yet to interview Oswald. Apparently had two daughters. Not a lot of people knew that. June and Audrey, they're still alive. And Marina, his ex-wife, Porter now, she got married. She's still alive, too. Have you been able to find them by any chance?
I would have been able to do that. But remember again, you know, I've had such an advantage over anybody who's ever written about the JFK assassination or Dorothy or Marilyn because my guiding light has always been Dorothy. And from the beginning when she was, and again, I have respect for others who have written about the JFK assassination, but they weren't there. I wasn't there. But Dorothy Kilgallen, as you know, was there, the celebrated journalist for the New York Journal American and a friend of JFK's. And when he was killed, she went to the Ruby trial. She interviewed Ruby, the only one to do so. And she had pretty well proven that JFK's death was orchestrated by Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans Don, and then covered up by J. Edgar Hoover. And so I've never spent as much time as other people have in the Oswald arena because Dorothy believed that the key to realizing what happened to JFK, you had to focus on Ruby, and so that's what I've done.
And you've done a great job. Let's talk about Carlos Marcello, if we can, or Cello, who was a mafia don from New Orleans, wasn't he?
Well, he was, and, you know, Dorothy, again, maybe some of your listeners will get tired of me saying this, but Dorothy has been my guiding light from the hereafter. She chose me to write her story in the bestseller, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, and then Denial of Justice. And then she kind of urged me, I'll put that in quotation marks, to write about her friendship with Marilyn Monroe and her ideas about Marilyn having not committed suicide, but having been murdered. And it's interesting because I had tried to see if I could find more information about what happened to Marcello after Dorothy died. I had found, and it's in Collateral Damage, the extent of the empire that he had that stretched from New Orleans to Dallas. As you know, he had underlings in Dallas and all of that. At that time, I think the estimate was that he had something in the neighborhood of about $300 million. He was a terrific, I mean, he's a terrible guy and responsible for an awful lot of deaths in and around New Orleans, but he was a smart businessman. And so as of 1965, he had that kind of an empire. But I tried a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI, nothing. I tried that with the CIA, nothing. And then one day I just had this feeling that Dorothy gives me, and I went to the National Archives, and there was a brand new FBI memo, very lengthy, about Carlos Marcello in 1968-69. And what it showed, I have it right in front of me, it was amazing, George, because his wealth had increased greatly then. They had these informants that had got close enough to Marcello to know when he was going to the bathroom, for heaven's sakes, who he was having lunch with and all of that. But it talked about the fact that, you know, he was such a smart businessman. For instance, the place that he dealt most of his business at was this Churchill Farms estate outside of New Orleans. It talked about at one point that he bought all the land around there because he knew an interstate was going by there. It talked about, you know, the dealings that he had with other real estate situations where, you know, he could make money that way. And so the point of all that is this, and I want to see what you think of it. We know that, you know, he could not let Dorothy Kilgallen write about him in the book that he was writing for Random House and expose the fact that she believed he orchestrated JFK's death. He had that empire. We can talk about, you know, that you need to look at why Bobby Kennedy wasn't killed instead of JFK was, you know, but the whole matter was that Dorothy figured out that he had orchestrated JFK's death, and he was going to put that in the book for Random House. Well, he couldn't let her do that. That would have destroyed his empire. And then if you look at this document, you see that he had such a larger empire as you got to 68. And the reason that I was interested in that is why? Because Bobby Kennedy died in 1968.
That's right.
And so I would ask some of your listeners to think about this, and you as well, and see what you think. But his empire was so large in 1968, even larger than it had been in 65, that he couldn't let Bobby Kennedy become president of the United States. He also knew that Bobby Kennedy would come after him with everything the government had, because Bobby Kennedy basically admitted he knew that it was Marcello that killed his brother. And so there's your motive that you have. And what's interesting there is, if anybody can help me with this, I would love to have them do it, because I really believe the strongest motive to kill Robert Kennedy is Carlos Marcello, but I've never been able to connect him to Sirhan Sirhan or the fellow, I think is one of his names is Caesar, the man standing beside Sirhan when RFK was killed.
Well, let me tell you, Mark.
I can't make that leap, and I wish I could, because that would help us get some truth about what happened to RFK as well.
I don't think there's a connection between Sirhan Sirhan and Marcello. I don't think Sirhan really played a part in it. He was there. You know, the Kennedys family has supported, by and large, the parole of Sirhan. He's still in jail. He hasn't been let go yet. But I don't think there's a connection there. I think Marcello did what he did. I think you're absolutely correct. I would add an ingredient to this that you may have investigated, and that is Jimmy Hoffa. As you know, back in 1975, I was one of the last reporters to talk to
him. That's right.
At that point, there was no connection between Hoffa and JFK's assassination, even though Hoffa hated Bobby Kennedy. And so as I am walking Hoffa to his car after he was on one of my television shows, I didn't ask him that question, like, did you know anything about the JFK assassination or anything like that? But I have a feeling that Hoffa was killed by Marcello. Hoffa dies in 1975. He disappears. We still haven't found him. Marcello dies in 1993. I think he had to shut him up, too, because he was afraid Hoffa was going to say something.
Well, that certainly would have been the way Marcello did things. It's interesting. James Hoffa, his name is in this FBI memo I found. F. Lee Bailey is in there. Melvin Belli is in there. Jack Ruby is in there. You know, he had his hands on all of those, those situations. So it wouldn't surprise me. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that about, you know, the situation with Hoffa. But remember, Frank Regano, the Tampa Bay, Tampa, Florida lawyer, represented Marcello, Hoffa, and Santo Trafficante.
That's right.
And
Hoffa
Regano
knew them.
Regano is in here. Regano traveled to New Orleans to meet with Marcello and all that. So he was in the middle of all that, and you may very well be right about that, George.
I don't think Hoffa played a role in the assassination, but I think he knew the players involved in the assassination, and that's one of the reasons they had to shut him up.
Well, they had to shut up Oswald, and they had to shut up Ruby by giving him Melvin Belli and that ludicrous trial and all of that. So, you know, that's the way it worked. In fact, it talks about, you'll get a kick out of this, in the memo, that Joe Marcello, who was, Marcello, if I'm saying that right, Carlos's brother, wasn't smart enough to figure out how to run the real estate business, so they put him in charge of looking after the local gangsters and everything like that. So maybe they sent him to look after James Hoffa, I don't know.
Marina Oswald, who's now Marina Porter, she got remarried 2 years after Oswald was killed, has always contended that he didn't have anything to do with the assassination.
Well, that's a lot more possible than the whole Oswald alone thing, that's for sure. I mean, it's amazing to me that these books keep coming out, and the Sixth Floor Museum at Daley Plaza, they keep perpetuating Oswald alone. You know, it's interesting that way. You know, I've had people who said, wait a minute, Mark, Sirhan was a patsy in terms of the killing of RFK, and Oswald was a patsy with regard to the JFK assassination, and they may be right. There certainly are similarities there.
You have uncovered some new evidence about Dorothy Kilgallen that I want to go through. You also wrote a very important letter to the Los Angeles County District Attorney, who has never responded to you yet, has he?
Well, I've written three of them. People say I'm crazy to try to get him to reinvestigate Marilyn's death. But I first sent him a copy of Collateral Damage, a 375-page evidence report, all of the evidence that I have that, you know, from credible sources, including new evidence that I can mention to you on the show tonight. You know, it was amazing to me because I really felt like that I would be able to get a fair shake from him. But then, I don't know what you think of the Sirhan parole situation. From my days as a criminal defense lawyer, I'm a big believer in juries. They don't always get it right, but most of the time they do. And so, you know, that jury heard the evidence. They convicted Sirhan. He was sentenced to death and all of that. And I'm a little bit skeptical of Bobby Kennedy just because of his pattern of always wanting to try to be the big shot. You know, that's one of the reasons he got involved with that torrid love affair that I've proven in Collateral Damage through the CIA documents during the summer of 62, because I think he wanted to show his father, Joe, who had his trophy girlfriend, Gloria Swanson, the movie actress, and then JFK had the glamorous Jackie, and he was sleeping with every woman he met on the side of the street. And I think Bobby wanted to show them he could have a trophy girlfriend, and so he went after Marilyn. It always seemed to me like he was, you know, he was the run of the litter of the Kennedy family. He was always trying to kind of show off and everything like that. And now he comes along and decides, he goes to see Sirhan, and he decides to, you know, back the parole and everything. A lot of members of his family don't agree at all with regard to that. But that's what he decided to do. And so I'm a little bit skeptical of that whole situation with regard to why he came forward at that particular time. Are you in favor of what he did there, George?
No, I'm not. I don't believe in parole for people convicted of murder.
Yeah. Well, Gaston, how this fits in is what upset me after my second letter got there is that when he was asked about, Gaston, the L.A. County D.A., was asked about the Saran parole, he first of all said, you know, I won't get involved because I believe a DA's job ends with a jury verdict or a judicial verdict of some sort. Well, I practiced law for a long time in criminal courts. I've never heard of any prosecutor saying that. He represents the victim. He represents Robert Kennedy. And so he should do everything, including of being involved in the parole hearing. But then he said that he idolized the Kennedys. I can get very emotionally wrapped around my personal feelings about someone that I thought could have been an incredible president for the country. Well, George, he can't be an independent prosecutor, an independent DA, looking at my request to reinvestigate Marilyn's death based on all of the evidence that I have. So I wrote him a long letter. It's on my website, markshaw.com. People can look at it. And I really gave him hell. I said, hey, you need to recuse yourself and appoint an independent prosecutor.
Absolutely. Hold on, Mark. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back and talk more. Plus, we'll take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.